Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Miko Peled, an Israeli peace activist and author of the book The General's Son, who reflects on the obstacles to peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the perspective of the son of an Israeli war hero and staunch Zionist. Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the transition movement that seeks to build community resilience in the face of such challenges as peak oil, climate change, and the economic crisis. And Frances Moore LePay, author of the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet, who talks about her most recent book, Ecomind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The growing search for non-Middle Eastern oil has put new focus on West Africa and the Guinea coast. In 2009, China's state oil company, Sinopec, won control over oil leases in Sao Tome and the Principe development zone. The deal made China a major player in importing West African crude oil. Around the same time, the U.S. military began building up its presence in the nearby Gulf of Guinea by constructing small so-called lily pad bases with a low profile. While the U.S. has an interest in patrolling West African waters to interdict growing drug traffic in the area, other major reasons for Washington's increased presence include competition with China for access to this region's rich oil reserves and use of the area as a jumping-off point to project American military power farther inland to nations battling Islamic insurgents in such countries as Mali and Niger. While China is using its cultural links to Portuguese-speaking Macau to expand trade into West Africa, including the tiny oil-rich nation of Equatorial Guinea, Washington has enlisted Brazil to act on its behalf to counter Chinese influence in the area's former Portuguese colonies. The Obama administration would like Brazil to act as a junior police force in West Africa, but Brazil is also acting to protect its own investments and commerce in the region. Caleb Vines returned home from two tours in the Iraq War in 2006. He's currently one of the tens of thousands of victims of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Caleb also suffers from traumatic brain injury from multiple concussions during combat. During his tour, the former soldier survived 20 explosions, including IEDs, in Iraq. According to Mother Jones magazine, Caleb's doctors are not sure of the full extent of his injuries. He experiences flashbacks where he believes himself to be suddenly back in the Iraqi war zone. His troubles were compounded by a 4-year delay in his PTSD diagnosis. Caleb's wife, Brannon, and his daughter, Katie, experienced secondary traumatic stress. Symptoms include depression, alienation, and compassion fatigue. Secondary stress disorder was first detected among Vietnam-era veterans and families and observed in spouses of Israeli and Dutch war veterans. Robert Mata, a clinical psychologist at Hofstra University, insists trauma is a contagious disease. It affects everyone in close contact with a traumatized person. But family PTSD therapy programs available to active duty personnel are not available to discharged veterans, their spouses, or children. A massive oxygen-depleted dead zone the size of Connecticut haunts fishermen trying to make a living in the Gulf of Mexico near the Mississippi River Delta. According to the American Prospect magazine, the dead zone in the Gulf is caused by an overload of nitrogen and phosphorus nutrients originating from agricultural fertilizers. As corn prices soared over the last decade and production spiked, so has the nutrient pollution moving downstream from farm belt states to the waters of the Gulf. Across the globe, dead zones have been linked to industrial agriculture. A 2008 study in Science magazine identified 400 dead bodies of water, including Mobile Bay, Alabama, and Long Island Sound. Yet rivers and bodies of water can revive themselves if the nutrient pollution stops. In Eastern Europe, the Black Sea partially came back to life in the 1990s after the Soviet Union collapsed and subsidies for fertilizers were ended. But the pollution load continues to grow along the Mississippi as corn production surges to meet rising demand in Asia and production of ethanol increases. Many Gulf environmentalists fear there is little hope in combating the dead zone without a radical overhaul of U.S. agricultural policy, including a move away from growing commodity crops for export. But today there is little interest in funding alternative sustainable agriculture models. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Miko Peled took a circuitous route to becoming a Middle East peace activist. He grew up in Israel, the son of Matti Peled, a war hero who fought in the Jewish state's War of Independence in 1948 and who served as a general in 1967 when Israel annexed Gaza, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and Sinai Peninsula. Peled's grandfather was Avraham Nadelson, a Zionist leader and signer of Israel's Declaration of Independence. Miko's current activism can be traced to his father's transformation from a general during the Six-Day War to becoming a scholar in the Arabic language and literature at Tel Aviv University. General Peled later became a passionate peace activist and an advocate of negotiations with the then-outlawed Palestinian Liberation Organization. As a member of the Israeli Knesset or Parliament, he campaigned for an Israeli withdrawal from all the occupied territories he had earlier helped conquer as a general. A family tragedy resulting from political violence in Israel would become a catalyst in Miko's own transformation. A 1997 Palestinian suicide bomb attack in Jerusalem that took the life of his 13-year-old niece, Smadar, became Miko's moment of political awakening. His 2012 book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is a memoir of his family and personal history, recounting his service with the Israeli Special Forces, immigration to the U.S., and his later rejection of Zionism and the advocacy for a one-state solution. Your reporter spoke with Miko Peled, who talks about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the unique perspective of the son of an Israeli war hero and army veteran turned peace activist.
2 years after my father passed away, he passed away in 1995. 2 years later, in September of 1997, my sister's daughter, who was 13 at the time, was killed in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem. She and several other Israelis. And this, of course, was big news in Israel, as it always is, but it was slightly bigger news because here was the granddaughter of a well-known general, and not only was he a general, but he also made a name for himself as a peace advocate, and so with the Palestinians mainly. And so this was very big news. I was living in the U.S. already at the time. I took the first flight home, and when I got to my sister's apartment in Jerusalem, it was already packed with reporters and people came to express their sorrow. And after the funeral, my sister came out, and she was, of course, asked by the reporters about revenge and retaliation and who she thinks is responsible and so on, or what should be done with the people who are responsible. And she made it very clear. She said, she made a couple of very simple statements that really shook everyone, including me. At first, she said that in terms of retaliation and revenge, she said, look, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. You know, the thought of killing people as a response to the killing of people is absurd. And you know, motherhood being this uniting thing, it unites people beyond any divisions. And that's what she called on. And then she said, in terms of who's responsible, she said, the oppression and the brutality of the Israeli occupation against the Palestinians or upon the Palestinians is so great that we've managed to bring these two young men such a level of hopelessness that they killed themselves, and they took innocent civilians with them. I mean, you can't ignore that. She said, there's no point in blaming them. We have to find out the root cause, and the root cause is the oppression, because she said, when you take away people's land and destroy their homes, and you incarcerate their fathers for, unlimited, years in jail, and then you shoot them, and you shoot their brothers and sisters in the schools, which is what Israel does, she said, then this is what happens. So we're paying the price. And she said very clearly that she held the Israeli government responsible for her daughter's death. And of course, this made even bigger waves, because here comes an Israeli bereaved mother and turns everything upside down, because we know that the Palestinians are the aggressors, they're the terrorists, and the Israelis are the victims who always wanted peace. And when I came back here, you can't just go back to life the next day as though nothing happened. When you see that little grave of a 13-year-old child, I mean, you just can't go about your business like nothing happened. And I was very fortunate that I found a group here in San Diego. It was a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group. And it was the first time I met Palestinians. Now, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city, is also very segregated. It's a very racist city. So I never met Palestinians until I was here. So it was a very interesting experience for me, and that kind of led me into this exploration and journey, which is, the book is called The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli into Palestine. And that began my journey, which has been going on for a long time now.
Miko, there's a lot of pessimism that peace negotiations will resume anytime soon. and that a long-lasting and just peace will be found anytime soon. What is your recommendation as an Israeli citizen, someone who served in the armed forces? Certainly, you may not have the majority viewpoint of most Israelis, but you do bring something unique to the table in terms of your family history, in terms of your personal loss, and in terms of perspectives maybe you've gained by living outside of Israel for some time. Tell us about your advocacy for a way to break this logjam of this many decades long and very bloody conflict between Israelis and Palestinians.
The reality is that no American president can really make a difference, can make a dent in this issue, because there's such a strong Israeli lobby that has completely controlling, on this particular issue, is controlling American politics and American politicians. No American president can bring about a solution unless they're able to say one of the following things: that Israel must respect human rights and civil rights of the Palestinians, that Israel must release thousands of political prisoners, which Israel called terrorists, but not, most of them have not been charged with acts of violence. Most of them are political prisoners. That Israel allow Palestinians the same amounts of water as it allows Israelis. That Israel stop killing civilians indiscriminately. I mean, until you start having that kind of a conversation, there's not going to be any change, because until Israel stops doing these things, there's not going to be a change. So an American president can't do that, because if he does, the Israeli lobby will shut down Washington, D.C., you know, and there won't be any legislation or anything else going on. That's the reality. The way I see this, Israel has in fact created a reality where there is one state over the entire country. We'll call it Israel or call it Palestine, but it's one state, and it's the state of Israel. The West Bank is fully integrated into the state of Israel. So that's not going anywhere. There's never going to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank. Israel has integrated, and everybody knows this. So the question is, do we keep things the way they are? And I think it's a question of values, not so much politics. Keep things the way they are. Keep half the population disenfranchised and the state representing only half the population, allowing Israel to keep thousands of political prisoners, allowing Israel to keep discriminating against Palestinians and in aspects of land and water and rights and freedom and so on. Or is there another choice? And the other choice would be to transform this country into a democracy and to allow Palestinians and everybody else who lives there to be equal citizens. The notion of a state of all of its citizens is something that's illegal to propose even in Israel, because it's suggesting it won't be a Jewish state. But the thing is, I don't think you can have a Jewish state and have a democracy when half the population is not Jewish.
That was Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. For more unique perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The annual Slow Living Summit in Brattleboro, Vermont, is a gathering focused on sustainable living, resilient communities, and the personal inner transformations that are necessary for both. At this year's summit, June 5th through 7th, some of the plenaries and workshops included presenters on the transition movement, made up of people who recognize the seismic shift in society that's occurring due to peak oil and climate disruption, and who want to prepare themselves and their communities to make that transition as smoothly as possible. They're learning how to make clothing, preserve food, and harness renewable energy sources. Another key feature of the transition movement is its adherence commitment to building personal relationships and a network of mutual support. Chuck Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of the group's program on inequality and the common good. In 1995, he co-founded United for a Fair Economy to address issues of economic inequality. His latest book is 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. He's also a transition activist in Jamaica Plain, an economically and racially diverse section of Boston. When he heard about the Slow Living Summit, he asked to facilitate a plenary session on transitioning to a new economy and recruited Massachusetts transition trainer Tina Clark and environmental activist and systems thinker Gus Speth to be presenters. He also facilitated a workshop on emergency preparedness, after which Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with him about how these various strands of the progressive movement can be integrated.
We had a session earlier about emergency preparedness. Well, there's an issue that completely cuts across politics. You can be a climate denier, but you probably think that that communities should be prepared for blizzards and power outages and ice storms and earthquakes and, you know, things that come along that through no fault of our own. So there's an example where people talking to their neighbors in a non-ideological way can, you know, maybe build some interesting coalitions. I mean, the anti-fracking movement across New York State is a great example of place-based response to an outside threat. And that does get a lot of people in action. I think we haven't paid enough attention to the more neighborly, face-to-face, small group, bottom-up organizing, and that those cells are important. At the same time, you know, need to have sort of a cohort of people who, for whatever reason, are paying attention to the signs of the times around climate change and want to engage directly in that and contest power in that area. It's really fundamentally about organizing block by block and in neighborhoods. That's going to reach a new group of people. Everybody agrees we should know our neighbors, we should know who's vulnerable, and we want to help each other. That connects and that reaches people. And when people are in a relationship, then I think you can have conversations. Well, have you noticed we're having more weird weather events? You know, I think that's connected to the changing climate. We have to sort of respond to that too. I think that's a very bottom-up way to both diversify and get more people to face an overarching catastrophic threat that can't be just sort of, oh, it's climate catastrophe or climate change is not just one of 10 things anymore that we should be. It's going to have an overriding impact on the economy and food system and work and energy and everything. So it does have a special category, special status. As much as people say, oh, that's an environmental issue, Mother Earth bats last, and she has the final say.
Chuck Collins, at this conference and among transition communities in general, the vast majority of folks involved are older white people, you know, most coming from relatively educated and skilled backgrounds. How much of a problem is this?
At the local level, I think it's really a problem if local organizing efforts haven't sort of figured out how to bridge class and race diversity in their community. It's going to hold us back. That's a huge part of what we're trying to work on in Jamaica Plain. I mean, we have an organizer who's Latino, and we're trying to bridge the multiple JPs and doing events in Spanish language and doing events in different venues, and actually, more important, connecting the themes that are most urgent to low-income and communities of color to kind of the transition agenda, not and vice versa. But I'm not also totally surprised if you think about if people have the slack or the social capital, if you will, to be future-oriented, to look at external threats that are somewhat abstract. That is really not for everybody. Most people live in the present. They live in the sort of day-to-day present in terms of their economic needs, or they live in the past even. It is a somewhat small segment of people who read and think about threats in their more abstract state, the number of parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. Pretty soon that's going to change. I mean, the extreme weather events, the challenges of another economic downturn, whatever it is, will become a moment, a teachable moment and a organizing moment around the transition.
One other question, and it's been raised here already a number of times, is the whole issue of language, like how you address this issue. If you talk about transition, I mean, it means a lot, it's like could mean anything, could mean a lot of different things. And JP, I guess they call them resilience circles. I mean, who can be against resilience, right? Does it matter what it's called? And people are saying, well, it doesn't matter what you call it. You know, it just matters what you do. I mean, just like the whole concept of global warming, like, oh, warming is so nice, you know, instead of calling it climate catastrophe. Yeah. So, I mean, words really are important. What do you think about what the vocabulary is that's out there so far? And do you think there's something else that would be better?
Well, I think we just have to keep testing out. No advertising slogan works for everybody. I think we have to be open to making mistakes, or recognizing mistakes and changing the framing and the messaging. And for instance, in our neighborhood, if you organize and bring people together under the banner of climate catastrophe and peak oil, you know, you'll get a crowd in the room, but it'll be one crowd. It'll be people who have sort of that environmental framework. If you say, how are we going to face rising food and fuel prices, and how are we going to connect with young people about their future jobs of the future and their livelihoods and how to get out of debt and have good lives, that brings another group of people, brings the equity group. There's the environmental people and the equity people. Each of them have urgencies that are kind of different and are focused in different places. They're both legitimate urgencies, but we should not be too locked into any particular language or framing.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good, and an activist with the Jamaica Plain Transition Movement. Learn more about the transition movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Frances Moore LePay wrote her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, in 1971, little did she know that her research would move a nation to reconsider what they ate and how modern agriculture and factory farming negatively impacted world hunger and the planet's ecosystem. The book, which sold 3 million copies, extolled the virtues of a vegetarian diet and changed the way a new generation thought about food, nutrition, and health. You can trace today's popularity of organic food, the mainstreaming of vegetarianism and healthy food marketing strategies, to many of the ideas written in LePay's Diet for a Small Planet, published more than 40 years ago. LePay would go on to co-found the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, with Joseph Collins in 1975, with a mission to educate Americans about the causes of world hunger. Along with her daughter Anna, Frances Moore LePay founded the Small Planet Institute in 2001 to promote a concept they called living democracy, a culture in which citizens infuse the values of inclusion, fairness, and mutual accountability into all dimensions of public life. In her most recent book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want, LePay argues that humanity's capacity for making the world healthier and more sustainable is undermined by 7 thought traps that leave us mired in fear, guilt, and despair. She proposes specific thought leaps as correctives to the thought traps, turning challenges into opportunities. Your reporter spoke with Frances Moore LePay about the ideas presented in EcoMind and her assessment of the movements that have organized in response to the global climate crisis.
What I'm asking us is to really look at some of the core foundational assumptions of our worldview, what I call our mental map, as regards the environment, because I've learned now that the reason that we are creating together a world that none of us as individuals would choose is because of the big ideas we hold that keep us from seeing solutions and keep us trapped. I flip 7 what I call thought traps, kind of disempowering ideas, and I turn them around on their head in a way and say, wait a minute, is that really true? Is there another way that's more empowering, that's more ecological, that's more evidence-based?
Thanks for that. You know, and if I could just read briefly the 7 thought traps that are discussed in the book. The first one is no growth is the answer. Consumer society is the problem. We've hit the limits on finite Earth. We must overcome human nature to save the planet. To save our planet, we have to override humanity's natural resistance to rules. Humans have lost the connection to nature. And the 7th dire one, it's too late. It's too late to do anything, just throwing up our hands. But, you know, I was very much encouraged by the first thought trap that you talk about, which was no growth is the answer, which, you know, I've always thought that the problems in our economic system, I'm sure I share this with a lot of our listeners and just people generally, that this constant drive and race to grow and grow and grow was, you know, a huge part of the problem of why we were destroying the planet and, you know, bulldozing forests and burning things up and creating climate change. But you're saying that the framing it like that is possibly detrimental to fixing the problem. And I wonder if you just expand on that.
Yeah, because it sounds commonsensical, right? Would you put it that way, and how could I possibly disagree with you? And of course, on one level, it's correct. But what I'm suggesting is that it keeps us in the, I think, of non-ecological worldview of quantities, that our problem is additive, that it's too much, and if we just cut back. But of course, just if we look a little bit deeper, we realize that it's not a quantity problem. It's more of a systems problem. It's a relational problem. And what we're currently doing now is actually more waste and destruction than it is real growth. But what I'm really saying is that if we just focus on growth and its enemy, then we are blind to the way that our system is actually creating more waste and destruction than growth. So that's where I start in my flipping it around.
Frances Moore LePay, right now we have groups like 350.org and many other associated groups around the country trying to work on public consciousness raising around global warming, climate change, and trying to prevent the building of the Keystone XL pipeline and a lot of other fights around mountaintop removal, coal mining, things we talk a lot about on this program. How do you think they're doing things right or doing things wrong and trying to raise consciousness and
you know, get everybody on board in terms of a consensus that we have to change our policies and change our economy to a great extent to survive what is already coming in terms of these extreme weather conditions, drought, the failure of crops and everything associated with it, the disappearance of fresh potable water and the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly admire all those folks you just mentioned. My desire, however, my emphasis is that what I want to figure out how to put my energies toward better than I have been is how do we create the canopy over all of that. I'm a child of the 60s, and I loved being alive during that time when I felt like I was part of a movement that went way beyond what I was working on. I was a community organizer in Philly in anti-poverty organizing in African-American neighborhoods in Philly, but I felt like I was part of a women's movement, part of an ecology awakening. I mean, it was one glorious movement, whereas today I feel that there isn't that sense of a canopy over us all, and I think that canopy of hope, if you will, it's got to be that we know we are also tackling, besides our special interest of our particular issue, that we are also recognizing that we've got to get money out of control of our political system to really break through and shift the whole system. And that is a bipartisan issue. You know, more than 80% of us agree that corporations have too much power in our political system. And I call it the mother of all issues, and it's where we can come together, not abandoning our particular environmental or poverty or other issues, but knowing that we are really going to the root of it.
That was Frances Moore LaPay, author of 18 books, including the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet. Her newest book is titled Ecomind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Find out more about LaPay's books, articles, and projects by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.